You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wham Goat presents the Van Flip Podcast.
What is up? Welcome to this week's episode of Wham Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Today I am joined by Cannibal Corpse bass player, longtime member, original member, Alex Webster. Thank you very much for being a part of the Van Flip today, Al.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you guys have a busy tenure, but you've been busier in the last couple of years. You have a new album coming out. Well, as this airs, it comes out 2 days from now. Chaos Horrific is the 16th album in the long discography, along with some live albums, box sets, and other kind of like extended plays you guys have released over the years. So, we'll start with the basic questions that you would probably get asked in a regular interview, but like, what sets Chaos Horrific apart from like the other 15 albums in the discography?
Well, one of the big differences is just it was recorded more or less, you know, before we had even started the tour cycle for Violence Unimagined. Just because, you know, the pandemic obviously was a big, you know, disruption for everybody in the music industry and in all sorts of industries, of course. So we were in a position where we had an album coming out, Violence Unimagined, and didn't have any touring lined up for it. So we thought, let's just start writing right away, you know. So that's one of the things that pops out to me, is what's different about it. Well, it's different is that we started writing it really shortly after the one that came before it, and that's not something we'd normally do. And that may have changed a little bit of how we wrote for it, I think. Like, we were just kind of already, we were, the last album was still so fresh that we kind of knew not to repeat things that we did on that album. Like, I feel like this one turned out sounding, in a weird way, like a continuation of the last one, but also different because we avoided repeating ourselves. It was easier to avoid than it would have been after having toured on the album for 2 to 3 years, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I'm picking it up. Sorry, I was adjusting volumes as well.
Cool.
But yeah, one thing I definitely noticed about the beginning of the album is, you know, something that's kind of, you know, made fun of in death metal is the bass for, you know, tracking and recording and stuff like that. But on this particular album, it comes out right away and kind of like sticks you right in the face. And obviously you're known for your, you know, creative and ingenious ways of playing bass and showcasing bass. So, you know, you're kind of one of the purveyors of, like, you know, bass in death metal. So it is a great way to start the record off, I should say.
Oh, thanks. You know, I guess we hadn't really started a song with a bass intro in a little while, so it just seemed like something cool to do. And that song ended up being the one that just seemed like it should go first. Like, if you listen to all the songs on the album, you know, which when we go into the studio, we're not usually sure which song's going to be first, which one's going to be last or whatever. We kind of figure that out later on in the recording. And so we didn't know that one was going to be first, but it ended up seeming right, and I'm happy that it starts out with a bass part. It's cool because I didn't write a whole lot of other bass lines that are jumping out at you on this album, so it's nice to, you know, get it in there early, I guess. I've had other albums that have a lot more bass features, but at least this one started off with one.
How do you guys go about, you know, deciding that? Is it something that you decide, you know, early on, like, I'm going to take a back seat on this particular one, or like, this is the album that I'm going to show everybody, like, you know, what I can actually do in this form?
You know, it's a song by song kind of thing. And then sometimes like for bass playing anyway, just talking about like the bass lines I write, it'll be decided in the studio. For the title track of this album, I had written some kind of complicated bass parts for certain sections of it, and it just wound up feeling like they were going to detract. Even though they were kind of cool parts, but I'm like, you know what, let me just go more straightforward. Eric and I agreed that, you know, Eric's our guitar player but also our producer, and we agreed that straightforward approach would work for that part. So it's sort of a song by song thing. What's the song need? Sometimes we end up writing a bass line, you know, in the studio where it's like, okay, this is something I hadn't intended to do here, but it just works. So yeah, we take it song by song, figure out what's appropriate. If I'm writing the song, I can kind of fit something in. But if it's one of the other guys' songs, I'm not going to be like, hey, okay, this is a great part you got here, I'm going to put a solo on top of that. How's that sound? Or whatever. You know, I'm trying to do what they want and what would make their song sound the best when it's one of the songs they wrote.
Interesting. So when you guys, I know you have a studio where you live. Are you still out in Oregon currently?
Yes.
Okay, so yep. I know you have like a studio out where you're at, and you recorded most of the stuff during COVID for the last album, you know, in your place. Do you guys all like write separately and then just present it as a, you know, like a completed song? Or do you guys like share ideas around, you know, and how has that differed? Because again, you guys have been around for 30 plus years. Like, how has that differed over the course of like how you began writing and how it is like now?
Oh, it's different. Like now it is really individual. You know, Rob will write songs alone, I'll write songs alone, Eric will write songs alone, and then we'll basically be presenting the finished song to the band in demo form most of the time. That's what happens. But in the old days, a lot of times we didn't even think of the riff until we were all together.
Yeah.
You know, so it was really organic back then. You can kind of hear too how some of those songs meander. If you listen to our first few albums, there's some songs where it's like they have a whole ton of riffs. There's not much repetition because we were just kind of building it little by little in the practice room. And that gradually changed over time to where, oh, by maybe probably around the fifth album or so, it was mostly, you know, individual writers. It just seemed to be a more coherent way to make a song, you know. Like it's kind of fun though, and it's something I actually think about sometimes, like maybe we should do at least one song that way again, where one guy does a riff and then the next guy does a riff, and then, you know, and just see where it takes us and see if it's good or not.
I think someone on the spotness would, you know, cause some like spark and creativity, obviously, because like you were saying earlier, and I'm not trying to detract from the point you were trying to make, but you know, like obviously when the younger guys get into a room and they want to write something, you know, like you said earlier, you got something to prove, you want to, I mean, like, and you guys are writing all this stuff and doing all this stuff at a time where all this is kind of really just starting to kind of catch, you know, death metal is starting to get a wave, and you know, obviously Florida has their stuff going on, and you know, you're trying to outdo and outclass everybody else. So it would seem that, you know, you guys get in a room and just write the most craziest shit, and then after a couple of years of doing that, you kind of figure out, you know, you're not mature, I hate saying that word, but like figure out the sauce, you know.
Yeah I think, you know, we definitely were learning as we went. You know, I don't want to say we didn't know what we were doing, but we kind of didn't, you know, we were just figuring it out.
How old were you when you joined the band? Sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no worries. I was 19 when the band got together, I'm pretty sure. I would have just turned 19, like that October of 88. And everybody else was in that same age group, you know, between, say, 19 and 21, 22, thereabouts, you know. So we were all really young. I think a lot of us had taken lessons here or there as musicians, but overall we were learning by listening to Creator albums and Slayer albums, Dark Angel albums, you know what I mean? That's right, like we were trying to figure out what those bands were doing, you know, and other bands that we liked, and just kind of learning that way.
How hard was it for you as a, well, I know you started on guitar and then moved over to bass at some point, but like how hard was it for you as a bassist trying to figure out like what was going on in those earlier albums as it was like mixed down in the, you know, in the master? Hey, what's up? It's Lurk. Looks like you're enjoying the podcast. If you are and you like what we're doing here on the Van Flip, why don't you go ahead and pause this and give us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening to. If you want to find out any information on your favorite bands from the hardcore and metal scene, visit lambgoat.com. And to stay in the loop about everything that we post on lambgoat.com, make sure you like us on Facebook and you head over to Twitter and Instagram and follow us at lambgoat. Are you a full-grown adult and you also have a TikTok account? Congrats. Follow us on TikTok as well. You can find us under the username lambgoat.com. That's spelled out D-O-T-C-O-M. Head over to our YouTube channel where we have all of these podcasts in video format, plus a lot more content that you should check out. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and you hit that notification bell so you're always alerted when we upload new content. And last but not least, if you want to follow me, Lurk, the host of the show, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at LurkCity. And as always, if you need any of the links that pertain to the artists on the show today, Lambgoat, or myself, you can always find them in the description. Thanks for listening to this message. Now let's get back to the show.
Well, you know, actually, I never was a real guitar player. I've never been in a band as a guitar player or anything. I did have, I started when I was a real little kid, like learning some guitar, and then stopped that and started playing bass when I was, like around 14, I think. But this is, it's really, this kind of music, when it first came out, like most of the producers didn't know what to do with it. If you listen to like the kind of bass playing that you'd hear in a more traditional kind of heavy metal band like Judas Priest or Iron Maiden, those, it's really more tied into the drumming a lot of the time. Yeah. The guitars and the bass can be separate a lot of the time, where once you started having the thrash metal thing, like if you listen to Metallica's first few, actually all of their albums really, but I would say actually especially Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets, the guitar and the bass are really together. And it seems like they're doing the same riff most of the time. Mm. And so that was kind of what we were trying to do. And I think a lot of death metal bands, you know, pretty much everybody, like when you're thinking bass in death metal, you're thinking of someone who's basically trying to play what the guitar is doing as well.
Right.
And you add low tuning into that, which we did later on by our fifth album. We started doing some low tune stuff, and it makes it just that much harder, because then the guitars are starting to dip into the bass player space. So it's been a learning process the whole time. I'm still kind of figuring it out. Like I said, I'll work with the guys in the studio and we'll be like, well, what works here? Me trying to follow the bass part, or the guitar part, or should I do something simpler, or something a little harder, or just something completely different? So it's a learning process, because it's, there's certain things that are traditional in this kind of music, but overall I think there was a lot of stuff going on that was brand new.
Yeah,
you can hear it in the old thrash, death metal, black metal early albums from the 80s. You can tell that a lot of the producers didn't know what was going on. Maybe a lot of the guys in the bands weren't sure exactly what would be the best thing to do musically in each situation. It was just everybody was learning.
Yeah, you don't have a lot of reference points to like point to at that time frame. And God, there's, I could ask you a lot about, I don't want to get sidetracked. I want to have like a somewhat of a flow, but we're probably going to get all sidetracked here, because I have so many questions to ask you about the differences between that now and then and everything like that. But I'll try to keep us on track here. But speaking of which, being a part of the community for such a long time, like how have you, like your sound for, album A through Z or whatever, how does technology and how did just like your skill level change how like your bass sounds? Like how often do you find a different tone? How often do you approach it differently? And is it by song? Is it by album? Is it by just, era, so to speak? Or how do you go about that?
Probably I would say by album. Like each album we're trying to figure out a bass sound that will go with the rhythm guitar. The rhythm guitar ends up getting tracked first, like the final rhythm guitar. And so much of what makes a death metal album sound great, like a large percentage of it, is how the rhythm guitar sounds, and the bass is meant to complement that. Like it's pretty rare that you find someone talking about an album and saying that the bass tone made it or broke it, kind of thing.
Right.
They can say that about rhythm guitars. So the bass can be a little bit unsung in the way that it supports the rhythm guitar. So yeah, we could, I have a certain tone that I use live, and I kind of use that all the time. And our live sound man will dial me in the way he needs to dial me in, and it works well. But for each album, we'll end up just experimenting with different amps, different pedals, different things like that. You know, I use the same bass, same strings, you know, that kind of stuff, same pickups or whatever. That stuff is the same pretty much all the time. Mm. But we will mess around with the rig in the studio to make it support the rhythm guitar the best it can. So yeah, that's like the order, by the way, in the studio. Like, we'll get the drums down. Once the drums are down, to me, that's like the frame, the foundation and framework of the house, you know. And then after that, you're putting the rest of it on. And so then the rhythm guitar comes next, then the bass, and then they'll start in on vocals and solos. And then it's on to the mix after all that's done. So yeah, the bass, yeah, it varies depending on how the guitar tone turned out. Nice. You know, and that's, but yeah, that's something that we really want to make sound awesome. And I think we've had some really good guitar sounds, and hopefully my bass tones made them sound even better somehow, you know.
Do you procure your sound with a mix of analog and digital, or is it just one or the other, or, you know, like?
Well, we're pretty, you know, old school in that, yeah, we're miking a cabinet. Okay. I think I've only done one album with Cannibal Corpse where it was direct, and that was Skeletal Domain when Mark Lewis produced us. We used an Aguilar. I don't want to go too in the weeds with the gear here. I'm not sure how much people care, but we had an Aguilar Tone Hammer DI and a Dark Glass B7K DI, and we blended those. And that's what Mark used as the two channels. But for every other album, I'm pretty sure we've, you know, had a rig, you know, a bass amp, cabinet mic'd up. But we also do a DI line, and we might put a plug in on it. Like, I think we use the Dark Glass plug in on Chaos Horrific, and on a clean channel or something. Eric does all that stuff, you know. He'll record the mic, you know, the rig, the main signal, but then he'll also record a DI and maybe even an overdrive channel from it just depends. So he's got at least two channels to work with, and the one channel's completely clean in case something just goes wrong. There's this technology now that probably most of the musicians listening or watching this would know about called reamping. And if you have a good DI signal, then you can, it's a nice safety net if it turns out that your main signal isn't working in the mix or whatever. You can just play that DI through an amp. So it's like this track that you've already recorded. You play it through an amp and record the amped sound, and then it'll sound, you know, good. It'll sound like that setup, even if that wasn't the original setup that you had when you recorded that track. Cool. So we haven't had to do that, I don't think, with my bass, other than for Violence Unimagined. Mm-hmm. We had to do it because I recorded in Oregon and then sent the tracks down to Eric, and then he reamped them down there.
Right. That's interesting. So what was, do you prefer not to go direct? Is that why you've only chosen, or that, is that why you only did it the one time? Or was that more of like Mark's just experiment, or, you know, y'all's experiment with Mark in that space? And is it just something that didn't work for you guys as a band, and you just didn't go back to that? No offense to Mark or, you know, your choices in that album, but.
No, every producer we've worked with has done a great job, and they all have different styles, you know, and yeah, the guys liked Mark, but for sure Eric was a better fit, obviously, for what we wanted, I guess. But I love the work Mark did with us too. It's just two different kinds of production. But what I've learned since the early days, because when we first started going in, you know, Scott Burns was our producer in the beginning, and I remember sometimes we'd be like, hey, let us do this, let us do that, and after time we learned, hey, let's stay out of the producer's way, because that's why we hired him, to produce the album, you know. Like, let's not try and let our own idea of what this should sound like get in the way of the professional that we hired to do that. So I do that with the bass stuff. I have, like I said, I have a great live rig that I love, and that one I am in charge of, you know. Like, I put it together and I love it, and I will present it to each producer like, hey, this is what I use live. Do you think we can use it? And sometimes they can use it, sometimes they can use parts of it, or sometimes they want to completely use their own thing. But I don't want to force my live rig onto them and make them have to struggle with the album when they have some rig that they're so used to using that works so well for them. You know, I'll just, I try to stay out of the producer's way unless I really hear something going wrong, you know, like that I just can't stand. But I just, if we hire them, it's because we trusted them in the first place, because we heard them do other things that we thought were good.
Yeah.
So we try to stay out of their way. And then at the end, if the album isn't exactly what we'd hoped it would be or whatever, production wise, we might work with someone else, or we might work with someone else just to mix things up, even if we were satisfied. It really depends. But yeah, I stay out of their way. They know more about it than I do,
right?
You know,
is that a learned behavior over the years? Like, how long did it take you guys? How many albums did it take you guys to like realize, like, I can let go of some of the reins here because these people obviously know what they're doing, more so in that space than we do. But like, how long? How many albums were you into it before you figured that out?
I mean, Scott Burns was always producing those first five albums. But I think that we were probably suggesting stuff that we wouldn't bother suggesting later on. You know, like, hey, look, let's try this. Let's try that. It's like, hey, maybe let's just let Scott produce the album since he's the producer. You know, like, so we were probably, you know, it's possible that we could have been suggesting stuff that was pointless and sort of wasting his time occasionally. And after a while, you just learn, oh, okay, you know. Relax, we can trust them. Make a suggestion here or there, but overall, you know, if a guy's done a bunch of great sounding albums, just kind of, my recommendation to everyone, just let him do his thing, you know?
Yeah. How does Alex get into the, fall into the cracks of like death metal?
What's that? Like,
how did you fall in, how did you fall in line with death metal?
How did I get into it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably a very similar story to a lot of other people that are my age that were into metal in the 80s. Like, you know, I started out with, you know, Accept and Iron Maiden and stuff like that. You know, coming from liking rock as a kid, you know, just like regular rock.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, getting into Accept, Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, stuff like that. And then, you know, hearing Metallica. Especially, you know, it's weird. I heard a couple early Metallica songs on, I think it was either Metal Shop or Q107's Midnight Metal Hour. I grew up in Buffalo, as the other Cannibal guys were all from the Buffalo area. So we got two sets of radio stations. We'd get all the Buffalo ones and all the Toronto ones. And so the 97 Rock in Buffalo had Metal Shop, which was syndicated. And then they also did their own hour-long thing. And then Toronto had... Yeah, Q107, and they had Midnight Metal Hour. So we'd listen to both of those. And this is like so old school that sometimes I'd have like one of those old cassette decks and like set it next to the stereo to record with a little condenser mic, you know, just to get some of these things like and keep them and listen again, because that was the only way, really. So I remember hearing back on one of those old shows some Metallica songs, but they weren't the fast ones. I think that the guy on the radio show was like, oh, probably the fast stuff's going to be too much for my listeners. So I heard Fight Fire with Fire at a scout camp. One of the other scouts knew, you know, that I was into metal. He's like, hey, man, come here, check this out. He had a little radio in his tent, and he played me Fight Fire with Fire. And I was like, holy crap, how are they even doing that? Like, I couldn't, you know, so that kind of fast guitar picking with that kind of saturation and muting, and just really even up and down picking to where it's James Hetfield's up and down picking on that song and on most of the stuff he does really is so consistent. And that level of saturation and palm muting was so new at that time that I didn't know what was going on. I'm like, how is he doing it? It sounds like all down picks, but it's the speed of up and down picking. And it just, it's a great song, really kind of a weird arrangement too. Like to this day, I would say that's kind of a hard song to learn to play, even though it's, you know, 40 years old plus now, or yeah, just about 40 years old, I guess. So that, I know that's not death metal, but that kind of led me, that was one of those moments that I remember.
Right.
Like, well, like holy
like
shit.
This, it like altered the trajectory a little bit.
Absolutely. That was a big one, you know, like, it, and I still love the old, you know, the old school heavy metal that I liked, you know, that, well, it wasn't ever a thing where like all of a sudden those bands became obsolete.
Yeah.
I still listened to them too, but I was like, wow, this is, this is really awesome. And I had heard Venom and a couple fast bands like that, but they weren't, I hadn't heard that kind of precision before with the picking and the performance and everything. So, so that was a big moment for sure. And that made me think that's what I want to play if I can, because of course it sounded just impossible.
So
at that time,
you're not playing guitar when you're first finding Metallica. You weren't playing instruments or anything like that when you.
I just was getting into playing bass and guitar a little bit, both. Okay. Like I had a kind of a beginner guitar and a beginner bass, and I did start taking bass lessons, but I would still mess around with guitar a little for fun. But it became clear bass was what I wanted to do, even though I had both instruments available to me.
Was it more because of and I'm sorry to keep harping on that, but was it more of rock influence playing that you're doing at this particular point? And then, you know, as you progress in your musical journey, you're finding like Metallica, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh.
Yeah. I started out trajectory. Like, I remember getting together with some friends from school that also played music and liked rock and metal, and we played like Rocky Like a Hurricane, not very good, at least on my end. I can say I don't want to. We played that song probably 20 times together, or whatever. We had a couple songs like that that we could sort of get through, and we just play the heck out of them. It was just so much fun to play music with other people.
Yeah,
that's really one of the big driving forces for me to like want to be a musician, was to be part of something like that, to hear it all happening at once. You know, it's one thing to sit at home and practice, and you know, that's fine, I still enjoy that, but really it's just so much fun hearing it all coming together.
Yeah.
You and your friends making music together, and choosing bass, part of it for sure, I mean, I love the way bass sounded and everything, I love the role it played in the band, but I also am the kind of guy who likes to set reasonable goals. And if you're listening to like Van Halen or AC/DC, I've used this example a few other times, but you don't know how to play an instrument at all, what seems more reasonable? Learning to do Michael Anthony's job or Eddie Van Halen's job? Or learning to do Cliff Williams' job or learning to do Angus Young's job? You know, like, I'm like, I think I could actually play bass in a band. Yeah. But at the time, I was like, there's just no way. Those guys playing lead guitar, that stuff's borderline magic, you know. It's like I couldn't even imagine as a beginning musician being able to play like that. So I love how bass sounded. I loved it's what it did in a band, you know, like bass player like Peter Baltes from Accept, Cliff Williams and Mark Evans from AC/DC, the stuff that they wrote, obviously Iron Maiden too, but for sure I really liked some of those guys who did the straightforward stuff, you know. Like I liked hearing that foundation. So and it also did seem like a not unreasonable goal to strive for, to be able to play that kind of bass. And then, you know, as I heard the harder and harder stuff and became a little better, I wanted to push myself. But in the beginning, I just wanted to lay it down. And there's always something like that still in my head, to where if a song sounds better with me just laying it down, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm not going to try and force a bunch of tech stuff in there just to have it in there.
Do you, how long do you have to spend with the song before you realize, like, oh, I can lay it down or I can jazz it up? Like, how long do you spend with a song before, you know, you're like, that part's complete, or this song is complete bass wise?
It depends. You know, sometimes it's pretty obvious, and then other times, you know, we figure it out in the studio. Like a lot of the bass parts I do, some of the ones where it's different from the guitar, especially on Rob and Eric's songs. Like I said, for my own songs, I have more time to think about it. But for their songs, a lot of the time I come in knowing the riffs, but then I'm like, well, what really is going to sound good here, guys? And they'll be in the studio with me and we'll talk about it and we'll try different things. You know, they'll say, hey, try it. Eric, for example, he likes me doing chromatic stuff underneath some of these parts, which makes it sound like, you know, like a walking bass line, really, where you're kind of walking between chord tones and that. And that's something I hadn't done a whole lot. I usually kind of stuck to chord tones when I would write things, you know, keeping everything really in key. And he would like to have those little bits of dissonance. There's a part like that in the title track, Chaos Horrific. It's not easy to hear, actually, but there is some chromatics in there, and that was at Eric's suggestion.
Hmm. I'm just going to bring this up, and then I'm going to ask the next question. You have a peculiar style of, like, your galloping triple finger feet here.
Yes.
Is that something you saw someone do, or is that something that just came out of necessity, or, like,
I have a very exact answer for this, and it's really, more than anything, it's from trying to figure out what Steve DiGiorgio was doing on Sadus's demos and then their first album, Illusions, which later became known as Chemical Exposure. But I could tell it was fingerstyle bass playing. I could tell it was really fast. Like, you know, Steve's still a great friend and an amazing bass player. You know, I've known him since, I'll finish the story, actually. I didn't know what was going on, and this is like late 80s. I'm like, man, how's this guy doing this? And this is back when people would write to each other. Mm-hmm. Sometimes contact information would have a phone number or something. Sadus's didn't, but it did say that they were in Antioch, California. And I remember, you know, like that was... And so I'm like, oh, well, what if I call information and see if I can find Steve's phone number? So I actually did that. And, you know, this sounds crazy nowadays. Yeah. People would never do that. But back then I used to get people cold calling me like, hey man, you know, I got your number from so-and-so. And it was the only way to get in touch pre-internet. Right. You know, you would either that or you'd write. And we were doing plenty of both, you know? So I called up Steve. I'm like, dude, I just had to talk to you. I love how you play. And he was totally accommodating. Even though it's a little weird back then, not nearly as weird as it would be now, but he was, you know, super patient with me. He explained to me the way he does things, which, again, not to go too deep into tech stuff, but he would get a pattern of four by going back to the middle finger. That's what he said. So starting with the ring, middle, index, ring, and just repeat that. And so I was super grateful for that. We ended up staying in touch as pen pals and then later meeting in person once they started touring and we started touring. And now we see each other, you know, regularly because he's in Testament and we're Cannibal Tours. So we end up touring with them or seeing them at festivals pretty often. But yeah, he really accommodated. He taught me that. So I sat there trying to learn it and I kept trying and trying, but really my fingers ended up falling into playing it a different way. And I'd end up accenting, I guess, every, you know, because what you're trying to do with your three fingers to make it sound like that awesome up and down picking that guys like James Hetfield and, you know, a bunch of death metal, everybody in death metal is playing up and down and thrash too. To get that, to at least even try to do that fast with your fingers, you're trying to make these three fingers sound like four, because really for most people the pinky's just not going to do it. It's anatomically useless for a lot of us for plucking. It's just so much weaker. No matter what you do, you're not going to turn this little one into one of these bigger ones. It's, so for me, the fourth one moves, but that's just because it's attached. You know, people think I play with four fingers sometimes. I'm like, no, it would be more work to try and make this not move.
Yeah.
So basically accenting like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, like that. Like it's the accent, it's going across in three, but it's in groups of four. So it's a pattern that repeats every 12 notes. And if anybody's still awake out there, you're welcome to ask the next question.
No, I think these are the kinds of conversations that I like to have. Because again, like we do get into the nerdier things. But I mean, like, if we're going to be honest, I'm sure a lot of the people that follow you are bass people that are into bass, and you know, like, I'm sure they all have those questions, like, where does he get his tone from? You know,
I don't think anybody who's not interested in bass playing has made it this far into the interview.
Yeah,
so that's a good point. Yeah,
so yeah, we have all the people that we're only telling the stories they want to hear at this point. Yeah. One of the things I had James from our Human Furnace from Ringworm on, and I kept like saying like how the band had been around for 30 years, you know what I mean? And again, like, I don't want to keep like harping on like how long you guys have been around, but like, you know, you're coming up on 40 years almost, and like, that's just a feat in general for many, many different reasons, right? You have one other longtime original member, and I'm blanking on his name right now.
Oh, Paul Mazurkiewicz.
Paul, yeah, there it is. So it's just you and him, and like maintaining that tenure is insane. But also, like, maintaining a band within that this genre is insane. You know, you guys have been doing this, and I don't want to say this your only full-time gig, but I mean, you've also been doing Cannibal Corpse full-time, quote-unquote, for so long, too. There's, like, so many different feats that you guys have accomplished over the years. But the main question that I really wanted to know is, like, how do you guys just keep writing, you know, every album? Because, like, you know, you're into it 40 years, some of you guys, and, like, where do the ideas come from at this point?
Yeah, well, for the lyrics, it's almost like a different,
right,
different story from the music.
Yeah,
the lyrics to me, it's a little bit harder actually.
Okay.
Because we have to kind of think about different stories. I mean, we want to keep in this horror theme, you know, like, and usually the really violent side of horror is what we're dealing with, you know. So basically, it ends up being a very specific scenario. Like, you know, like, I'm trying to think. Pitchfork Impalement. That's very specific. You know, we might have had some other Impalement song earlier on, but Pitchfork, first time, pretty sure. I'll have to look through our lyrics. But you know what I mean. Like, it's kind of like we're being very specific. Like, well, look at Violence, their first album. I remember they have a song called Serial Killer.
Mm.
Killer song, by the way. Awesome song. But I'm thinking, well, hell, we couldn't do that. We've got, like, 20 songs about serial killers, but it has to be really specific about what each of them is doing and how it might be different from the other, different perspective, maybe victim's perspective, one-time killer's perspective, or just basic third person or whatever. So there's various different ways to approach doing things that are, I mean, we are repeating ourselves a bit, you know, of course, so we have to kind of get really specific for it not to be overly repetitive. But yeah, we've had a lot of serial killer songs, a lot of zombie songs, a lot of songs where people are being captured, you know, and having bad things done to them. You know, it's all the bad stuff we sing about it, or we have over the years. So that becomes tricky. Now, if we can switch to the music side of things, I actually think that's a little bit easier, because that's just one of my favorite things, is to sit down and start trying to write some new music. It's my favorite part at this point. Like, I love the touring, I love recording, although that's the hardest part, really. Recording's the hardest part because you're under the microscope, but the creative part, sitting down and writing music, is just so much fun. It's never a problem. You know, if it ever is, like, if I'm ever having a day where I'm just not feeling it, I'll just skip it and come back the next day. But usually, it flows pretty easily. And I think the other guys are probably like that too. And it's very helpful to have several guys who are really creative in the band and enjoy writing as well.
Yeah.
Because each of us write 3 or 4 songs musically, and maybe 3 or 4 songs lyrically too. And Paul joins in on the lyrics and sometimes the music as well. So, it helps that we're a team that everybody likes making creative content, you know what I mean? Like, we all like writing and expressing ourselves that way. And it's the fun part in many ways, you know?
Yeah.
So music, I'm not really too worried about repeating too. Like, on my side of it, like, the way if I'm going to start with a song just with a blank slate, I'm like, okay, let's pick a tempo, pick a scale, and pick a time signature. And we'll go from there and see if anything good comes out. So I might say, let's go 7/8, because that's always a cool kind of prog-ish sounding thing. But then we'll make it kind of fast, but something fast enough where I can pick all the 16th notes, so like 170 BPM.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, what scale? Hungarian minor is always a good one, or some, you know, whole tone scale. So those are, you know, I'll kind of set some parameters and then just go with that and see how it works out. Mm-hmm. And then for the next song, I'll make sure I don't use any of those things. That way the next song sounds different. Maybe the next song will just be 4/4 and then faster and different scale. So it's fun to give yourself a few boundaries to work within. It can be overwhelming to just start out and be like, well, what do I do? You know, so if you give yourself a few guidelines to work within, it can spur the creativity, I've found.
Yeah, it would be opposite for me. I would think that, like, the content lyrically, because you can pull from so many different, you know, actual real life experiences that happen, like with serial killers or any kind of, like, victim things or any horror things, like, you can pull from that, or like any you know, I feel like lyrically it's way easier. But again, that's why it's different between you and I. And, you know, I would think that writing a really fucking cohesive, dope song is musically is way harder than just fucking, you know, writing about the lyrics that go on top. But
yeah, and I mean, it's like you said earlier, though,
that's why you're doing, but that's why you're doing that, Alex, and that's why I'm not doing any of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, it helps, like I said, it just helps to have a bunch of different people. And then if you do come up with a good idea for the lyrics, you know, then it's like, okay, cool, I'm going to go with this thing that I managed to think of. But yeah, it's a little harder, you know, being on album 16. I mean, if you're really trying to keep it fresh, it's I feel like it's just a little bit harder for the lyrics than it is for the music.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. How have you guys overcome, and I don't know if you have fully overcame it yet, but how do you guys deal with like people who don't understand the lyrical content, or like the approach for like bands like Cannibal Corpse and death metal bands that, like, you know, grandeurize all this like horror and like, you know, brutal imagery? Because obviously, like, you know, one of the things I remember as a kid growing up was, which probably like made me not listen to Cannibal Corpse for a long period of time when I was younger, was the album artwork and stuff like that. Just was like that, it was crazy, just like all the other death metal bands were. But like, how have you guys overcome that, and how do you deal with it still to this day? Because obviously, like, culture's probably crazier now than it was 10 years ago, but either or.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've tried over the years in interviews, and I'll do it now, and we've done it, you know, hundreds of times before, but we'll say, you know, it's entertainment. Mm-hmm. We do not want to promote violence in any way, you know, like, just get that out of the way right away, that it's not different than somebody writing a horror novel or making a horror movie or any other form of violent entertainment. But I think where people get confused with the music is how it sounds, first of all. Right. You know, so it sounds really brutal, so to have these brutal lyrics on top of it, and you're presenting yourself in this really aggressive way on stage, like just totally raging, you know. So some people I could see on the outside of the scene not really understanding where we're coming from, you know, like, oh, are these guys like promoting this stuff that they sing about? It's like, no, that's not it. And any more than Stephen King is promoting something violent that happened in one of his books or whatever, you know. And we tried to be clear about that it's, you know, it's fictional entertainment. And it's confusing, I think, for music for the reasons I mentioned, and also because music is usually used by people to express something that they experienced in their life. They're writing about a relationship or some problem they've had, and we're writing about stuff that we have no experience with.
Yeah,
you know what I'm thankfully, you know what I mean? Like, it's all really disconnect. Horrible stuff.
Yeah, I think that is the biggest disconnect in the way and how you put that, because a lot of people do use music to even correlate to their personal life in general. Like, it could be a song for a specific moment, so a lot of people just equate the two together. And, you know, people don't, like, concept albums are really, they're fun, and I love concept albums, but, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily understand when it is a concept album or when it's not a concept album, so they don't necessarily know that it's a storyline they're following, or if it's like the artist's life or experience. So yeah, that makes a little bit of sense there.
Yeah, so, you know, we've tried to make that clear. And I think you know, when it comes to violent entertainment in general, I think probably people don't give themselves enough credit for being able to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, like, because if it was really that big of a thing, how could any of these horror movies even get made? I'm going to take death metal out of the picture for a minute and just look at how popular really violent horror movies are.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, they're way bigger than the biggest death metal band. You know, like, there's definitely a huge audience for macabre things. And I think the disconnect with music is some of that stuff I mentioned, to where it's just hard for people to understand music being used for horror, where it's easier for them to understand it being used for a book or a movie, you know, or a TV show or whatever. But yeah, some of the stuff, like, I didn't know, I hadn't followed the show, I guess it's Hannibal, and I ended up seeing an episode recently, and I was like, this was on network TV, this show? I couldn't believe it, because that's like R-rated violence.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, things have come a long way in terms of what people will accept.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I think overall people get it. You know, they know the difference between, you know, horror fiction and, you know, something that's real or whatever. So, and plus there's horrible stuff on the news all the time anyway.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of like,
you know,
it's kind of like back in the day you would so, and like they would have these like Faces of Death videos or the VHSs where, you know, you, mm-hmm. now you see all that stuff on Twitter and Instagram or TikTok all day long, those scenes. But beforehand, you could only see it like your buddy had to have like an older brother that had the tape. And then, of course, those mm-hmm. tapes all had like bands like Cannibal Corpse and all these other Napalm Death, you know, styled music, death metal in the background of it while all these wild images and videos are going on.
I think one thing that is important to mention too, you're talking about how things are accepted a mm-hmm. bit more now, but they will always be gross. You know,
yeah.
it's always grotesque, disturbing stuff. It should be. Yeah. That's how you should feel about these things. Right. You know what I mean? Like the artwork that we do, it's disturbing on purpose. It's not meant to be nice. You know what I mean? I don't ever want it to be like someone looks at Butchered at Birth and it's like, oh, that's nice. You know, like, no, it's
put that
it's
on the wall really there.
It's really disturbing, and that was the intent of the art, and ditto for the lyrics and the music. It's meant to be that way. You know, you don't want, you know, entertainment. I mean, you want that kind of stuff to be out there, and of course it's gross, you know, mm-hmm. but we also don't want people to feel like they shouldn't do it
yeah.
just because it's disturbing. You know what I mean? Like, it should be something that people can express. You know, obviously, like I said, horror movies are enormously popular, you know, there's clearly a morbid curiosity that people have.
For sure.
Not just people who like death metal.
Yeah, I agree. You know? I agree. This is an easy culprit or to point a finger at. I got two more real quick questions, and then I'll cut you loose because we've been running at it a little bit longer or a little longer here.
Cool.
One, speaking of grotesque imagery and album covers, what is Alex's favorite album cover for Cannibal Corpse? For Cannibal Corpse, EP, live album, or full length?
Well, the Butchered at Birth one is sort of the classic. I mean, that. If you have to pick one, that's really the iconic one, and it's just such a cool piece of art that Vince did. And then I really like the censored version of Gallery of Suicide.
Mm.
That one, it's like that kind of dark, kind of purple-brown kind of thing in this big, menacing-looking building. I really like that one, and that's not a gory one. You know, it just captures a vibe. And so that's one of my favorites, but I love all the stuff Vince has done. I think the one for Torture turned out great. All of them have turned out great, but you know, some we like more than others. But
yeah
Butchered at Birth, that's like the classic. And then I like the censored version of Gallery. I just thought it was a really cool building and atmosphere that he created with that artwork.
Nice. We'll have to throw those up on screen, so I may have to edit it, which is
cool.
A bummer. But, you know, we'll do it for the pod. my last thing that I'll ask about, and I'm sure you get asked periodically about it, but, like, did you guys have any kind of relationship with Jim Carrey during the Pet Detective stuff? Like, because I know he was into, you know, thrash metal at that time, but, like, have you guys maintained a relationship with Jim over the years, or...?
We have not, but we did get to hang out with him a little bit during the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was there, and we got to meet a little bit, and between takes he would come up and chat, you know. So, but it was 2 days. There were originally going to be more scenes, and we even did another song.
Mm-hmm.
Hammer Smashed Face made it into the movie.
Yeah,
one scene in the theatrical version, and then there's two scenes in the version that plays on cable TV. But we shot, I think, maybe four scenes, at least three, and a couple of them didn't make it in. But we spent 2 days there, and they were like 12-hour days. I think we were going 9 to 9.
Mm.
And all those fans, some of whom we were actually friends with in the audience, they just had to kind of stand around with us. I think they were each, I don't know how much money everybody was getting, probably like $50 a day or something like that.
Something
and we got a bit more because we were technically actors. Such a cool, weird experience. But yeah, he was really nice. He knew of our songs. You know, he had a couple that he asked us to play, and Rob had just joined the band, so we ended up playing ones that Rob knew for our set list. We didn't want him to have to mime a song he didn't know.
Right.
But I just thought it was cool that he knew enough about us to even request certain songs. Yeah. You know, it was really cool. Very nice guy. Everybody involved with the movie was really cool. And it's incredible how much I ended up looking at movies differently after that. Like, I never thought about the fact that they have to shoot everything twice when people are having a conversation. Mm-hmm. They shoot it once over one person's shoulder, and then they shoot it again. The whole conversation gets shot all over again over the other person's shoulder.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the cameras are meant to be invisible when you have a movie. You know, you couldn't show that. So it's they have to shoot everything twice. It takes a long time. And as hard as it is to record albums, God, making a movie, it's very tedious. I can't imagine.
Yeah, I agree.
those people work hard.
I agree.
You know?
I agree. That is something I don't necessarily... I mean, we edit some documentary-style stuff over here, but that's way more than we need to do. You know, I don't need my hands in every little thing like that. But, Alex, we appreciate your time. If you've made it this far, you are a bass head, and you've enjoyed yourself. So hopefully Alex answered some of your questions you've been dying to ask him about his tones and everything like that, and direct input or analog. So, yeah, this podcast comes out on the 20th. It's 20th now, so the 22nd, Chaos Horrific is going to drop. Make sure if you haven't pre-ordered it, pre-save it, check it out. You can find all of Alex's, not Alex's, but Cannibal Corpse's info and links in the description. And yeah, Alex, thanks for your time, and congratulations on the new record and the new touring cycle to come with everything for the next couple years for it.
Hey, thanks so much for the opportunity. And by the time this comes out, we should be just about starting our tour as well. So hope to see everybody out there. We got a great tour this fall, and it's Us, Mayhem, Gore Guts, and Blood Incantation. So check that out.
That's gonna be a good one. And possibly a new music video with the album, right?
That's right. Yeah, there'll be should be a video coming the day that the album comes out as well. So keep an eye out.
Cool. Thanks, Alex.
Hey, thanks so much, man.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.